The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the simplest, most powerful website creator that helps you make headlines with your own stunning online presence. Explore elegant templates, Getty image integration, and more at squarespace.com, and use the code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Hannah Devlin. Coming up on the show this week, we look at what makes some people brilliant public speakers and whether there's hope for those of us who sometimes find ourselves lost for words. Dr. Jo Devlin, a neuroscientist at UCL, decided to investigate why some of us have the gift of the gab. What's going on in the brains of these super speakers compared to us normal folk? I should point out that Jo's no relation, we just happen to share the same surname. We'll be talking to Joe about his experiments in spoken fluency and also to one of his human guinea pigs, the comedian Helen Keane. Also joining us in the studio is Ian Sample, the Guardian science editor, who will be casting his eye over this week's science news. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. If you've ever tried speaking on one subject for 60 seconds without repetition, hesitation, or deviation, you'll know that it's harder than it sounds. Why do some people appear to be such naturals at this, while others find themselves tongue-tied in front of an audience? Dr. Devlin recruited a group of comedians, TV presenters, and barristers to find out how these people are able to speak so fluently and in unscripted, high-pressure situations. Joining us now in the studio is Joe and Helen Keane from Radio 4's It Is Rocket Science. Welcome both.
Thanks very much.
Hello.
So Joe, being a fluent speaker is something that we definitely admire as a society, but is it something that neuroscience can tell us much about?
Well, neuroscience hasn't up to this point told us much about it. A lot of our interest in speaking and fluency is really about how things go wrong. So people who have stutters or stammers, people who have things like Parkinson's disease where they have difficulty initiating speech, or people who have things like Alzheimer's disease where their speech ends up being particularly kind of empty of content. So the majority of what's been done in neuroscience is really focused on how speech can go wrong and to some extent how it goes right in normal, healthy adults. There's been almost no interest whatsoever in how it goes really right, how it is that these people can speak fluently and in these kind of extemporaneous situations in a way that really fills the rest of us with awe.
And I guess it's probably not your average scientist, probably not your average news journalist either, like me and Ian, that are filling people with awe. Who did you go to when you were looking for these super speakers?
Well, I don't know. I suspect that if we had had you and Ian in the scanner, we'd have been really impressed. So the people that we brought in were primarily professional comedians, right? People who are in a stand-up situation have to deal with an audience in a live scenario, and they have to do it fluently, and they have to be entertaining while they do it. But they weren't the only ones. We also brought in a barrister who, again, has the same kind of situation in a courtroom, as well as a radio presenter who does live radio. And again, you're dealing with random calls from the public, and you have to just go with whatever is in front of you. And some of these people are so skilled at it that it really is impressive to most of us.
So was your idea that there could be specific differences in the brain, and did you have a hunch about what those might have been?
Well, we assume that this level of fluency and skill has got to manifest in some fashion in the brain, right? Otherwise, I guess we're stuck with some sort of dualist perspective where it's something that's a function of their soul or something. But we didn't really have any specific ideas about what the possibilities were. I mean, broadly speaking, there were two. They might use just the normal everyday system that the rest of us use when we're producing speech, but they could use it to a different extent or at different levels. The other possibility is they might recruit other areas of the brain outside of those that are used in normal speech production, and that would be suggestive of strategies that were being used that were different from what we would typically use in conversation. And that was exactly what we set out to find.
And so Helen was one of the people you picked to take part in this study, and you had a group of the super speakers, and you were comparing them to some controls who were presumably average speakers. Helen, can you just tell us a bit about how you got involved and what Joe made you do in the experiment?
Yeah, I actually heard about it from another comedian who's a friend of mine, Sarah Pascoe, who sent an email around to us all and said, oh, I've just done this crazy thing, you should all come and do it as well. So I think literally everybody she sent the email to was like, yeah, because basically we're all obviously, I guess, fans of Just a Minute and fans of seeing inside our own heads in a sort of vain comedian fashion, I guess.
What did Joe make you do when you came in for the study?
Well, we actually, we had to go inside the MRI scanner, completely inside it. And there was a screen above our heads, so we had to keep our heads completely still, because obviously that's how you image the brain. And we just had the topics flash up, so we didn't have any warning of what they would be. We just saw them coming up above our heads and just had to talk in the style of Just a Minute, so without hesitation, without deviation, without repetition on that topic, and just saying whatever came into your head, I guess, without while sticking to those rules.
And so you were doing this task where you were given a topic and you had to talk about it just off the cuff. It, whilst you were lying inside the scanner?
Yeah, inside the scanner was quite curious, actually, because it's obviously quite a strange environment to be performing, in inverted commas, in. So you have a mirror, as well as the screen above your head, you have a mirror that gives you the optical illusion of being vertical rather than horizontal, which is meant to make you feel less claustrophobic. And actually does work, although it made me slightly worry that I was balancing on my head and at any moment I would suddenly topple, causing untold damage to this incredibly expensive piece of machinery, and it would all get very awkward. It was a very strange environment, also because you are essentially performing, because you're trying to be entertaining and you're trying to stick to all these rules, but you can't actually see your audience. You've no idea of what sort of feedback you're getting. So in some ways that's my ideal gig, but in others it was quite odd, because you have to sort of keep up the level of being entertaining and being just a minute-y, but at the same time no idea what sort of reception it's getting.
How do you do something like that, Helen, and keep still? Because I've only met you for the first time today, but you're fairly mobile when
yes.
you talk, and I'm wondering how you do that in the scanner.
I don't know, actually. I was very still, though, wasn't I? I think I did manage to, because I was always worried about it, because whenever
you were terrific.
Yeah, whenever I have my hair cut, it always ends up with, like, completely different lengths, because I'm always, like, moving my head around while I'm talking to the hairdresser. So I don't know how. I think I must have just been very motivated, Joe. That's all I can say. I was very interested in the whole experiment, so that must have been what it was.
Yeah, there's no doubt. You were fantastic at it, because one of the issues that we have, right, when you ask somebody to speak, is it's hard not to move your head just as you're moving your mouth, let alone all the normal movements associated with speaking. And yet you and a surprisingly large number of our participants were really good. I mean, the total head movement was minuscule, you know, under a millimeter or something, which is remarkable. And that's exactly what we hope for as neuroscientists when we run these kind of things. So thank you.
How do you approach the task when you're asked to do this?
Well, I think in this instance, because this is a terrible confession, but because there was an audience, I think you're always sort of thinking, oh, well, I'm here as a comedian, so I've kind of got to be funny. So I didn't just think, oh, well, I'm just going to list everything I know about Edinburgh, for instance, on the topics. I thought, oh, right, how can I be funny about this? How can I personalise this? How can I talk about some of my bleak experiences at the Edinburgh Fringe? And, you know, just get that in. And yeah, so I think I was always sort of quite focused on that as a sort of another goal over the goal of not repeating words, not hesitating, not deviating from the topic. So if anything, I suppose I was putting more into it, but that made some of the other stuff easier, I guess.
What sort of subjects were you asked about?
Oh gosh, all sorts of things. They were just random, weren't they? They were kind of like city. I can't even remember half of them. They were sort of cities and how, you know, I don't know, probably.
They were a little bit banal topics, not as fun as you would have gotten on proper Just a Minute, because when we asked our normal speakers or healthy controls, they weren't very good at this task, so we couldn't really challenge them with anything that was too interesting. We couldn't give them, you know, Mexican warlords or anything like that. We asked you to speak about Scotland, a perfect cup of tea, topics like that that should have been easy for everyone, but in reality were quite a challenge for quite a lot of our participants. Comedians and barristers and radio presenters, however, found it a much easier task.
Can I just ask about some of the neuroscience that you sort of had before you went to this study? And that was whether you can say what areas of the brain were known to be involved in speaking and fluency of speaking. And did you think that maybe the difference between the two characters might be how they respond to stress, whether the stress sort of improves that kind of behavior or whether it inhibits that kind of behavior?
Right. So that's a fantastic question, because we do know the sort of areas of the brain that are particularly engaged in producing speech. What we do is we argue about what each area is really contributing to the task. But that's the main thing about this kind of Just a Minute task. You're trying to keep in mind the fact that you're not allowed to hesitate, so you have to just keep going. You're not allowed to repeat, so you're you know, carefully monitoring all the things that you're saying, which is a hard thing to do anyway. And then, of course, you can't deviate from the topic or deviate from English as we know it. And all of those things make it a much more difficult task than just normal speech elicitation.
Joe, what were the differences that you saw between the two groups?
So there were two sets of differences. The first finding really was that the control subjects and our super speakers were using the same exact system. The super speakers weren't bringing in extra brain regions to do the task in a way that was different from the way normal everyday people speak. And that was really interesting. But the other thing that was fascinating was the fact that they were using the system in a slightly different way. So some parts of the brain they had sort of upregulated in terms of the demands, and others they had decreased the demands on. So in particular, the parts of the brain that are involved in self-monitoring and keeping the task in mind were the parts that showed greater activity in our super speakers than in our controls. In addition, they also showed less activity in parts of the brain that were involved in the actual mechanics of producing speech. So Broca's area and some of the tissue around Broca's area is really critical for articulating, controlling your breathing, and all of those kind of things that are low level and boring, but super important whenever you're speaking. The fact that they show less activity there indicates that they just find it less effortful. And I suspect that a large part of that has to do with practice, frankly.
But what parts of the brain are involved? Is it just one or two parts in normal speech and then it recruits other parts of the brain for this more super fluent speech?
No, it's the same set of regions that are involved in both groups. And what was interesting is you get classic language areas like Broca's area, which is part of the frontal cortex, which is classically involved in language production since the days of Paul Broca in 1860s. And also Wernicke's area, which is a part of the brain that's sensitive to hearing the sound of your own speech, as well as things like primary auditory cortex, because of course you're sensitive to the fact that you can hear yourself, even in a loud scanner. And then we see premotor areas that are involved in the actual articulation process, controlling the speech stream, making sure that you're forming the sounds right, all the mechanics of speech that's not particularly interesting, but it's nonetheless important. And in fact, you also get a couple of other premotor areas and prefrontal areas, which are really critical for this cognitive control. And that's true in anybody speaking. And it was even more true in our super speakers. They showed greater activation precisely in the areas that were sensitive to monitoring and task control. And they showed less activation than our normals in areas that were involved in the mechanics of speaking, so some of the articulation processes. So it's as if they're much better able to keep the task demands in memory and deliver while monitoring their own performance. That's increasing in terms of demands. But there's decreasing demands on the actual mechanics of delivering it, possibly because you're a born speaker or possibly because it's something that you've practiced for years and years and years. This study doesn't tell us in that particular case.
So for me, the idea of getting up on a stage at a comedy club is terrifying, and I'm sure I'd just be completely speechless. What's going through your head during those moments?
I think for me, I think it really varies between different comedians. And I think some comedians certainly are very good at sort of extemporizing. They're very good at sort of fluently coming up with things in the spur of the moment. But I think there are also a lot of other comedians, and I would be in that category, I think, who very carefully plan what they're going to say. And even if you're making something look spontaneous, it is actually an illusion. It's not actually something you've just thought of. Then maybe it's something you thought of on stage on another occasion and you thought, oh, I must do that again because that really nice little tangent worked so well. So I think part of the fluency in speaking is making it seem like you're saying it for the first time, even if you have prepared quite carefully what you've said. I don't want to sort of pull back the curtain here and reveal all the tricks of the trade, but I think that's definitely something that goes on with a lot, if not most, comedians, I think.
I guess a lot of people would think that comedians, maybe as children, are really gregarious, the class clown type character. But that's not what happened in your case, is it?
No, I wasn't really. I think I was always kind of maybe a bit of a show off in with my family maybe and stuff. But yeah, I was very extremely quiet at school. I was, I later found out I was selectively mute. So I was very anxious about speaking in front of people I didn't know. I was quiet for whole days at a time at school. I didn't really speak even particularly to answer the register some days. It was that kind of school, no one noticed. But it's lucky. So it's very much something that I came to later in life. And it was partly, I guess that's partly how I ended up doing comedy, because I was having all these problems speaking, I got very interested in sort of taking drama classes and really just thinking about what is actually going on when you are speaking. What is it to sort of try and convey what you feel and think inside to other people outside? And I think that's sort of partly the route that led me into comedy, really, I guess.
And does that suggest, Joe, that you can do things to dramatically improve how good you are at speaking fluently.
Well, I think Helen is perfect proof that you can dramatically improve how good you are at speaking fluently, right? And I think it raises an interesting question, right? Which is the extent to which these things are learnable and improvable versus how much is born innately into someone, right? And everybody has a friend who they admire for their fluency. They're the storyteller in the group, and we all sort of look up to their ability to work the crowd, and it's fantastic. And there's a sense among a lot of these people that they were just born that way. They've done it to their family and friends, and they were goofballs at school, and they always got in trouble, but you still looked up to them because they were fantastic at it. So I think that there's two possibilities there, and our data don't really speak to which are, you know, is at play here. And it could, of course, be a combination. And that's something that we'd really like to follow up in a second study, which is to look at this trajectory for people who are starting their, say, comedy career over a couple year period. So scan them at the beginning, scan them maybe a few years in when they've had thousands of hours of actual live practice, and try to figure out whether those differences that we see are there from the beginning, which suggests an important role for nature that's just born that way, versus are really further developed considerably and show up at the end of the study when people have put in the time to see the differences. And depending on what the results are, it has really interesting implications for different kind of applications.
Joe, I was interested in the kind of natural variation you get in people's ability to speak fluently. And I've certainly interviewed politicians before who have been incredibly fluent, regardless of what party they stand for or what have you, incredibly fluent and really effective speakers, down to, you know, plenty of other people who struggle to get a sentence together. And I'm just interested in what you see. When we look at politicians, is that really like the top few percent of communicators that get kind of self-selected into those jobs or what?
Well, that was one of the things that we were interested in looking at with our normal control group, right? And there is variation in what we see in their ability to produce fluent speech. It wasn't a huge amount of variability, and that probably reflects our selection criteria. I think that had we had Boris Johnson and Tony Blair on the one hand and some of our less fluent undergraduates on the other, then we might have seen a wider range. But there is a certain gradation that's there to begin with, and it doesn't seem to manifest in the same way as when we compared the normals to our expert speakers as a group. We look at things in the brain that covaried with fluency, and what we see is some areas in the brain that were related to sort of memory in some ways. So I suspect it's because a lot of our normal speakers saw it as sort of a Wikipedia test. They'd see a topic and then try to produce as many facts on the topic as they possibly could. Whereas a lot of our comedians were very much more the raconteurs, right? They'd see a topic and then relate it to something in their life, and they make it interesting and engaging, and they weren't quite so just the facts, ma'am. So it could be that these differences in the brain patterns were actually due to different strategies that they adopted to do the task. But nonetheless, it does seem to be the case that this variation exists. And I suspect that very much so the people who are really talented, for whatever reason, whether it was born or bred, are the people who self-select off to do tasks and jobs that use this ability.
Joe, do you think ultimately from this work you can arrive at anything that will help people with problems in speaking to get better?
I don't think that it's going to be very helpful for clinical populations who have fluency problems as a result of some kind of neurological or physical disorder. The group that I think it's potentially helpful for are normal speakers who are interested in improving their fluency. And there are a lot of reasons you might want to, right? I mean, it's a form of social power. You get this respect from it. It may help you in your everyday job. So if it turns out that there is a significant nurture component, that is, it's learnable, then the key aspects that are essential for developing a good comedian may be translatable into kind of intervention programs where we can offer that skill set to people through practice and workshops.
But Joe, what if it's more of an innate skill? What are the implications then?
Well, that's really interesting, right? Because if it is the case that people are born fluent, then you could imagine that you could probably get a feel for this relatively early on in school by doing some kind of simple sort of fluency tests and looking at that spectrum of responses. And the kids who are doing particularly well in fluency tasks, you might want to encourage further. You might suggest that there are certain paths that really fit their skill set. And these would be things that involve speaking fluently in front of audiences, particularly in a kind of extemporaneous fashion.
Or you go to the ones who aren't particularly good at it and you make sure that they get this extra boost in in fluency to help them, you know, bring them up so those jobs aren't kind of excluded to them, yeah?
Right, absolutely. So if it turns out that it's just nature, there's nothing much we can do there. But it's, in all likelihood, it's going to be some combination of the two. Everything is, right? In which case, then you could definitely be tailoring some of the education system to try to help them improve. And it may be that very much these techniques that we learn from the current super speakers are the kind of things that we can bring into the educational environment, and educational neuroscience is a hot topic at the moment, so I'd love to see that happen.
Joey, there's some amazing research coming through in the US at the moment where they're using neural implants in patients to be able to record the brain activity and then computationally translate that into language, so actually being able to decode language in the brain. Is this something that you think could have applications in the future?
Well, I think you're probably talking about Edward Chang's work, which is really incredible. And as you said, it's been fantastic because they measure these signals directly on the surface of the brain, and they run them through a computer and into a speech synthesizer and produce speech based solely on the brain activity, not actually on the ability, you know, the person actually speaking. And, you know, it sounds like science fiction because, you know, if this is something that we can do and do well, it has incredible opportunities, not least of which is patients who are in these kind of comas or persistent vegetative states who you want to try to communicate with, but maybe they're just locked in. Well, if they don't have to actually produce speech, if we can record it and then, you know, artificially produce it based directly on their brain signals, that would represent a massive breakthrough. So I think that this is super exciting area that's going on at the moment. I think we're, you know, many steps away from, you know, wheeling this device out and using it on our patients. But the fact that it's possible is an amazing step forward, and it's really exciting.
Joe, where's your research going next after this particular study?
What we'd like to do is get in a bunch of aspiring comedians, right, who are inclined to be public speakers and perform on stage already, and then follow them over the course of a couple years, really, and see how the activity associated with speech production changes over time. So we can really get at how much of it is innate, how much was born to the person, versus how much they've actually practiced up and gotten better and better at. And then we can feed that information back and try to apply it to sort of normal population.
So, Joe, last question. In the study, you had Joe Lycett, Richard Herring, Robin Ince, Sarah Pascal, and obviously Helen all in the scanner. Who had the best brain activity out of the group?
Well, the strongest brain activity in this study was clearly Helen. She was amazing, and she was an incredibly fluent speaker.
On that note, Helen, yeah, and Joe, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Guardian listeners get the latest news, but they can also create it. With our sponsor Squarespace, you can easily create an elegant website for your personal brand, online store, business, personal portfolio, or blog. Whoever you are, Squarespace's simple tools and elegant designs make your ideas newsworthy and accessible to any audience. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
This is the biggest story in the world.
We will look back on these times and we will think, what on earth were we doing?
From The Guardian.
This is a story about people, and this is a story about possibility.
It's a story that's eluded us for decades.
It's clearly the most important story that we could be thinking about, and yet you scan the daily newspapers and it's almost absent.
A topic which The Guardian is now throwing itself wholeheartedly into.
I'd seen how we'd done it on other things.
Climate change.
Bill's simple proposition and his urgent plea was, this stuff has to be kept in the ground. It cannot be dug up.
So we're letting you in behind the scenes. Editorial meetings, bids for commissions. You'll hear what works, as well as our mistakes. And along the way, you can judge how we do. Is there a new way to make the world care?
That's the challenge. What can you do that will force them to sit up and pay attention?
The biggest story in the world on The Guardian.
Let's turn to the week in science. Ian, what have you been looking at this week?
Well, I was interested in a study from the Salk Institute in the US, which was showing how you can use genome editing, a technique that uses enzymes to cut out sections of DNA, how you can use that technique to try and correct mutations in mitochondrial DNA in cells. Now, people probably know that these mitochondria are referred to as kind of the powerhouses of cells. You have often thousands of them in the cells of your, in each cell in your body, and they generate a lot of energy for the cell. They have their own DNA as well. So what this research is showing is that, and it was done in mice, but they've shown that they can use this technique called genome editing to go in and take out mutations in mitochondrial DNA, and the hope being that you can use that kind of procedure to prevent a woman's affected eggs from passing on mitochondrial DNA mutations and mitochondrial diseases to their children. Now, mitochondria are passed on only down the maternal line from mother to children. So it could be a really interesting technique. It's a long way off at the moment, and it's really interesting, I think, from a UK perspective, because the UK has just passed through laws that allow a procedure to deal with these kinds of diseases to be performed. And
is this the three parent baby?
Yeah, exactly. Technique. What the press insist on calling three parent babies, although what that means for parenthood, I don't know. What it involves in the UK, the procedure that's been allowed in the UK is you have a couple who want to have a baby. If the mother has mitochondrial DNA mutations and is at risk of passing on mitochondrial disease. Under this procedure, you can have a woman who donates essentially healthy mitochondrial DNA from her own eggs, and that is inserted into the eggs for the woman. You basically swap them over. And so you end up with an embryo that has 99 point whatever percent of its DNA coming from the two genetic parents, and then this pretty tiny genetic contribution from the donor. And it's caused a lot of controversy in the UK, and there are some good reasons around why it's controversial. It's an unknown procedure, and it does involve you passing on genetic differences, genetic changes down the, what they call the germline, down from generation to generation. What this procedure would do is do away with that donor, and you would be going in early on the embryo or on the eggs, making the genetic change, and then hoping that has a big enough difference on the health of the cells that you don't get the disease later on.
And are there reasons that would be easier or preferable or less controversial in terms of the genetic changes that you're making, if, of course, it works in humans?
So it's not going to happen particularly soon. And one reason is that this has to be tested in a lot of human tissues, in human eggs, to see if you can make... if you can get rid of damaging mutations in the eggs without causing any other problems. And one of the issues that you always have to look at with genome editing techniques is what you call off-site mutations or off-site changes. So these enzymes that you inject to make the edit, they can sometimes find an area in the genome that they think is the target and make cuts to the DNA there, which would cause problems if it's not actually cutting out the damaging mutation. So that is something that needs to be tested. It's potentially quite an interesting one and a kind of beneficial one. It does away with the need for a donor, so some people will be happy about that.
So is it possible that we might never actually need the three-parent scenario that we've spent so long debating in the scientific community and also in Parliament?
It's always good to have people coming from different angles on things like this, especially when you're trying to prevent diseases that, in this case, are utterly debilitating, usually life-threatening. I mean, some of these diseases at their worst can kill children in their early teens before that, and they're truly horrific diseases. Now, does this mean we don't need mitochondrial transfer, which is this technique that involves a donor with their healthy mitochondrial DNA? Probably not, because what happens is if you're affected by mitochondrial DNA disease, your cells will have often varying amounts of mutations in them. Now, if each cell has thousands of mitochondria, it may be that, say, 10% have damaging mutations in. It may be that 90% have damaging mutations in. And for each condition, and often in each organ, there may be a different threshold that the organ can kind of get by with without there being a problem. Now, this genome editing technique, what it seems to do is bring down the level of damaging mutation. So it doesn't eradicate it completely. So what you're thinking about is if you can use genome editing to bring down the sort of load of mutations, the damaging mutations, to from say, I don't know, 60% to 20%, then that might mean that the children born from that, they have some mitochondrial DNA problems, but they may not be badly affected by the disease. What happens with the mitochondrial transfer technique, which the UK has now made legal, is you're completely swapping in healthy mitochondrial DNA. So you're going to have far fewer damaging mitochondrial DNA being passed on. So that is probably still going to be the alternative, and at the moment, the only procedure for women who have a lot of mutations.
So normally in science, we're always focused on the next big invention, this week's discovery. But I think you've been looking back this week as well at the Hubble Space Telescope. Can you just tell us a bit about who you've been talking to about Hubble?
Well, it's the 25th anniversary of Hubble being launched, and Hubble Space Telescope has really defined in many ways, I think, what we really know about the universe, certainly what the sort of the those of us on the sort of the outside know about it, who aren't sort of, you know, involved deeply in the science, because we just get these relentless flood of images from Hubble, and it's told us some amazing things. It's certainly shown us some amazing things. I spoke to a bunch of people involved in the project, going back to one of the scientists who joined the project in the early 70s and didn't leave until he retired in 2009. He spent more than 30 years working on Hubble, and it was essentially his life. He was a senior scientist on the project. And I spoke to a program manager there and was in touch with the astronaut who actually in 1990 was on the space shuttle and operated the robotic arm that had to grab Hubble out of the payload bay, lift it up, and then drop it in space. And this is, you know, 400 miles above the Earth. And they, as the shuttle backed away, they caught these beautiful pictures of Hubble just soaring over South America. And it's a lovely story what happened with Hubble. When it was delayed for 7 years, it didn't go up for many reasons, one of them being a delay due to Challenger, the Challenger incident in 86. But it was delayed to 1990. When it finally went up, everyone was in, you know, absolutely giddy with delight that this telescope, this enormous sort of bus-sized space observatory, was finally in orbit. But then when the first images came down, they were terrible. And the room that was there and reporters had been invited along, against the will of a lot of the astronomers there, when the first image flickered up on the screen, there was just head-in-hands moments. And the engineers thought they could solve it, but over a few weeks, it became clear that this was something that they couldn't tweak from Earth.
Were there people at the time who were saying, what the hell have we spent all this money on sending this telescope up there?
People were angry. They had spent a lot of money. They had spent a lot of time. And people within the science community were angry. They were livid that the problem happened with the telescope's primary mirror, which you can't fix from Earth. It's on the telescope. It's the main part of the telescope that collects all the light. It was an exquisite piece of machinery, that mirror. And what went wrong was really unfortunate for the guys who made it. It was a real shame, but it wasn't incompetence. It was just a bad luck. And what I love about this, though, is how they pulled it around. A lot of people left that project and went off and they badmouthed NASA and they were grumpy about it and they were, you know, really gutted and left and they quit. And a good core stayed on. And there's a lovely story about how a couple called Marjorie and Aidan Meinel were on sabbatical. They both of them were telescope engineers. They're on sabbatical at JPL and they knocked on the door of a guy who they knew was working on Hubble. They looked at the first images and immediately they diagnosed what the problem was. It's called spherical aberration. And it means that basically the light from the mirror isn't focused in the same spot. So all the images are destined to be blurred. Now, a few weeks later, the same people kind of bumped into each other at a conference, and it turned out that the couple had worked out what to do about this. And they realized that there was a backup copy of the main camera on Hubble being made at JPL at the time. And there were tiny little sort of coin-sized mirrors in this camera, which what you can do is you can actually bend them all. And if you bend them all exactly in the right way, when the light from the primary mirror hits them, you can cancel out the problem and you can totally neutralize it. So they did this. They flew that camera back up to the Hubble in 1993, 3 years later. They swapped them over And then when the first images came down from there, they were spectacular. And since that moment, really, wherever they pointed Hubble has just given us these utterly stunning images of the heavens and stars and galaxies. And they've done some amazing stuff. I mean, they've looked back to galaxies that formed 500 million years after the Big Bang. It's an incredible instrument.
So having spent 25 years collecting all these marvellous images, what's the future for Hubble? Is it going to carry on?
Since the space shuttle fleet was retired, there's now no way for astronauts to go back up to Hubble and service it. And it was always in the plan that Hubble could only really exist as long as it was being maintained. And the last servicing flight was flown in 2009. Now, around that time, NASA calculated pretty conservatively that they reckon Hubble probably had 7 or 8 more years. So we're looking at 2016, 2017 before the scientific instruments on it just start failing and it becomes less and less useful. Now, it'll probably be a fairly slow demise. I mean, you'll probably still be able to get science and data out of it for a long time as it deteriorates. What they did in 2009, apart from a bunch of other things, was attach a kind of docking module to it, which allows a rocket to go up to it, which will then be used to bring it down. So this is a massive piece of machinery, and you have to bring it down through the atmosphere. Most of it will burn up, but some of it won't, and you probably want to do that over the Pacific so that the debris will end up crashing down in the Pacific. Now, that could happen. Could be quite a while, because they can keep it up there a fair amount of time, even if it's not working. Just gives them time to get up there and start that whole procedure. By that time, hopefully, come 2018, Hubble's replacement, or successor at least, will be up there, the James Webb Space Telescope, which will try and carry on from where Hubble leaves off, which is using infrared to look back even further into the origins of the universe.
Thanks, Ian. And that's all we've got time for this week. A big thank you also to Joe Devlin and Helen Keane. From me, Hannah Devlin, and all at the Science team, thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.